Today, I want to talk more about grace, because the three groups that we're going to look at, the Lutherans, the Calvinists, and the Anabaptists, all agree, as Augustine said, that depravity is really total, that sin does to people what the urine in the water does to the water, that people are radically fallen. Where they disagree is discussing what grace can do for people. And you might think about it this way. When we talk about God's grace, what are we really talking about? Are we talking primarily about God's forgiveness, or are we talking, in addition to forgiveness, about empowerment? All right, so does grace forgive you, or does it forgive you and heal you and make you a different person so that you can live in a different, better way in the world, really be something different? I want to start with Luther. The distinctions I'm trying to draw between grace that forgives and grace that empowers would be to talk about justification and sanctification. All right? Justification is being forgiven. Sanctification is being regenerated. If you had to pick one word that you'd associate with Luther, would it be justification or sanctification? You can't have both. Although, of course, I mean, he talks about both, but which one does he talk about the most?
Justice.
Yeah, okay. All right, you're well-trained as Lutherans. Okay. Yeah, that's right. Only the Wesleyans and the Calvinists really sit around talking about sanctification. Luther says the world has been so ruined by sin that it's sliding into chaos. And the only thing that holds it from that chaos is God's goodness. And so the state for Luther is an order of preservation. Wouldn't have been a state without the fall. God institutes the state just to hold the world together, because people are so stricken by sin that without the state to coerce people, to make them be good, the world would just fall apart. People would be warring against each other all the time. The strong would be picking on the weak. Now, that kind of world where people have to be coerced into doing good is really alien to the world that Jesus talks about in the Sermon on the Mount. Because in that world, how do people relate to each other? If we all followed the Sermon on the Mount, what would life be like?
Heaven on earth.
Well, heaven on earth, or at least we'd all be responsible for each other, caring, sacrificing, all that kind of thing. And Luther says Christians have a great temptation to want to live according to the Sermon on the Mount, because it's a call of love and perfection. And Christ himself lived according to the Sermon on the Mount. So Christians will be tempted to do that. And in fact, they should do that in their private lives. But they must resist, he says, the temptation to withdraw from the world and live only according to the perfection of the Sermon on the Mount. Because remember, even though the world of government is a world of coercion and force, it exists because we need it. People need government, because that's what sin creates in us, a desire to do violence and take advantage of one another. So if you really love your neighbor, Luther says, you have to support government, because government punishes the wicked and protects the good. All right, so you're in sort of a funny situation. On the one hand, you're into the Sermon on the Mount. You really want to follow it. On the other hand, you realize that if you just follow the Sermon on the Mount, bad things are going to happen to your neighbor. Because if you just say, I'm going to be good, I'm not going to return evil for evil, I will not coerce another person, then people who are evil will coerce good people and will take advantage of them. And you won't have shown love for your neighbor because you will have allowed the world to go to hell, basically. So you're stuck. You're caught between two things. And he says, you might as well just admit that you're going to have to be schizophrenic. You are going to have to live in two kingdoms at once. All right, now a lot of you might be able to articulate this better than me because I'm sure that you've grown up hearing about two kingdoms. But you have two different callings. In your calling as a Christian, you're called to live according to the perfection of the gospel. And like if you're just walking around on the street or you're in your home and somebody attacks you, robs you, pillages, whatever, you should not return evil for evil. Because in your private life, as a Christian, you don't return evil for evil, even as Christ didn't. But in your public life, when you obey your vocation to be a citizen, perhaps even to be in government, well then of course you have to resist evil with evil. That's just the way it is. You have to respond to those who would take advantage of the neighbor with whatever force is necessary.
Well, would sanctions be considered returning evil with evil?
Possibly. People debate that. Some people say Jesus was non-resistant. He didn't try to coerce people in any way. Other people say, nah, it's all right. As long as you're nonviolent, you can resist. So sanctions are okay. So I think people debate really whether sanctions would fall under Jesus's non-resistant ethic or not. Luther assumed that most people, even though they were baptized, weren't Christian. And he said, if that's the case, there's no way that the government can be Christian. The world and its masses are and always will be unchristian, although they are all baptized and nominally Christian. To rule the world by the gospel alone would only be to loose the bands and chains of the wild and savage beasts and let them tear and mangle everyone. A person can be an executioner as a Christian vocation and kill people at work and then go home, and as they walk home they'll be non-resistant because they're not serving that vocation for the state when they're off duty. It's sort of a schizophrenic way to live.
Augustinian.
Yeah, the way I described Augustine, yeah, this is another example, and maybe even a sharper example, of Christ and culture and paradox. And we see here that Luther just says, hey, the world is always going to be unchristian. Just count on it. And don't even think that you can govern the world according to the Sermon on the Mount. Because all that will happen then is that you'll let the good people be eaten alive by the wild beasts. So don't even count on it. Christ and culture in paradox. And the people are living in two different kingdoms at one and the same time. And they just have to remind themselves what vocation they're serving at any particular time. It's very schizophrenic. Do you feel comfortable with that?
I hope not. I always knew I had to be grateful in this world.
Why not, John? What?
What other options are there?
Well, that's the Lutheran viewpoint.
Yeah, well,
do you all need Lutherans?
Well, that was Lutheran viewpoint in Martin Luther's time, if that helps.
Well, he changed even in his lifetime, I think, too. I'm not sure exactly what period you're reading from.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of his trust in his baptism, for example, to overcome anything and everything, was certainly a much more dominant theology that was more pervasive through his life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Trust in his baptism to overcome in what sense? To provide forgiveness and spiritual fellowship with God, or actually to transform himself in the world? Which one?
Well, and to cope, to deal with the realities of the expressions of evil that were around,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
rather than simply accepting the fact that it was the other way.
Yeah, Luther really respected order. On the one hand, anybody who reads any Luther will find out that the heart of what Luther is talking about is living in love for your neighbor. That's what justification frees you to do. Not to be worried all the time about your own salvation, but to accept it as a gift. And so you're freed from, you know, self-imprisonment, really. You're free to express your gratitude toward God by love for your neighbor. On the other hand, Luther does respect authority absolutely. He says you shouldn't be surprised when governments are bad. It's really rare to find a prince who's really worth having. And he says, you know, the princes should fear, because they can't expect that people will take that forever, and it's their own fault because they've governed so badly. But he also said to people, well, you know, if you get a bad government, you ought to ask yourself what you've done to deserve it. You know, of course, Luther always felt that everybody could repent all the time, so, you know, the princes, it was their fault, the people, it was their fault, everybody was at fault. But I guess, the most famous case of Luther really respecting authority and order beyond all else would be the Peasants' War. And Calvinists have to apologize for the burning of Servetus, and Lutherans have to apologize for the Peasants' War. Do you know what the Peasants' War was? Not really. Okay. Well, part of what was going on in the Reformation time in Germany was not just theological upheaval, but social upheaval as well. And a number of rights that peasants had traditionally held were being denied them by the princes, who really were sort of like landed gentry. And the peasants feared that perhaps they were being put back in a condition of being serfs, and they began to organize, and the princes began to organize, and Luther issued a statement to the princes denouncing them for their selfishness and for how poorly they had governed. He met with the peasants and told them, however, that he felt that the demands they were making were political demands and were not related to the gospel. And he warned them that if they revolted, he would side with the princes, because the princes, again, Romans 13, were God's authority. So the peasants did revolt. Luther did side with the princes, and he wrote a document against, oh, it has a really weird title, against the warring, thieving, murdering, raping peasants, in which he urged the princes to kill them all. That's, well, I mean, that's something that Lutherans live with. Luther respected authority very much. He didn't expect that the world would be transformed. Again, if you governed the world according to the gospel, all you would do would be to let wild beasts loose, to mangle the people who were good. And the church doesn't live by political rules. The church lives by the Spirit of Christ. Well, let me give you an example that you might think makes this position look more sensible.
Please.
I think we actually live according to this kind of graded ethic all the time. Did any of the men in here ever play football when you were younger, or hockey? Well, let's pretend that you did. Are any basketball players in here? Okay, all right. Football and hockey are better examples. Football's the best. Let's think about what people do when they play football. Or if you're a fan, what you hope your team does. Kill him! All right? Ruin him! Okay, he can't play, great. You know, you knocked him out, wonderful. Or at the least, you're using as much force as you can to see that your team wins. And we think that makes pretty much sense because that's what football is. But we'd be appalled if a football player behaved like that in normal society. Or same with basketball. What do you do when you're trying to get positions under the boards? You know, you butt people out the best that you can. Well, we would think it was really inappropriate if you did that on the way into the dining hall. It makes sense playing basketball, but it's rude going in to eat. Don't we sort of live like that all the time? If you think about the way you drive.
That doesn't make it
Yeah, in the same way I think Luther would say, if you were a parent and had children, wouldn't you expect to have authority over them in a way that you don't have authority over others just in regular life? In fact, don't parents coerce children at times? And you know that that's appropriate behavior, parent to child. It isn't appropriate behavior friend to friend or driving on the road. But every situation has different games and different rules, and we do what's appropriate to the situation. Or again, if you're feeling uncomfortable with it, ask yourself, do you really wish that we didn't have police, for example? They operate by coercion.
Wish that we didn't need police.
Okay, wish that we didn't need them, but do you wish that we didn't have them? Because they operate with our cooperation.
I guess I have a problem with if we did live according to the Sermon on the Mount, I don't understand why that would leave innocent people to the prey of evil.
Okay, all right. Can somebody help me out on that?
Well, the problem is that not everyone is going to follow it. If we all followed it, that would be fine.
But we won't.
Yeah.
But not everybody will.
And then it says the majority won't.
Okay.
And also, you have to remember what happened to Jesus when he followed the Sermon on the Mount.
Okay, so then are we supposed to be willing to have that happen?
For ourselves, yes, but for our neighbor, no.
Well, as you said before, because otherwise the society would be mangled and chewed to pieces, or however it was you put it. It's absolutely true, and we do live according to what Luther has said, but we absolutely do that. And it's the same thing that you said about Augustine yesterday.
Well, society clearly has to have some kind of order to it. But not just any, all orders aren't the same. And not yeah. just any old order, just because it has order doesn't mean that that's okay because it has order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, that's a really telling criticism to make of Luther. But I mean, I think it also might be possible to incorporate that sensibility and still try to work within two kingdoms. But yeah, I will say some scholars sit around and write essays like, would Hitler have happened if Germany weren't so strongly Lutheran?
It's pretty strongly Catholic too, though.
Yeah, it's pretty, and you know, also, I mean, Scandinavian countries were Lutheran and they didn't have Nazis. But, I mean, it's people speculate on things like
this. Trained in Catholic Church to start with. Maybe that's where some of his authority came from.
Mm-hmm. 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 Well, let's look at Calvin so you'll have something to compare this to. Calvin says, the thing I want to talk about is not justification, but sanctification. And I want to talk about the lordship of Christ over all of life. I want to talk about Christ transforming culture. Or, actually, he probably didn't say that, but Richard Niebuhr says that that's pretty much what he said. okay, with Luther's model, you just say, well, you're right, I have to punt the state. State's never going to be Christian. It really doesn't serve, it serves Christ, but it doesn't model itself upon Christ. It's an alien work of the gospel. Calvin says, no, that's not the way I want to think about things at all. I think that if Christ is Lord of all life. And he says, I don't think that the state is just an order of preservation. I think it's fundamental to who we are. We can expect a lot more out of it than Luther suggests. The state protects the church and guarantees it freedom to preach. It allows the church to determine how it is that holy people ought to live. Once the church determines that, the state puts it into effect. So Calvin says, if you really want to be a Christian, don't sit around whining that I want to be holy, but I really can't. I just can't quite make it today. Calvin says, you can be transformed. And what you need to do is pray about that, expect to be transformed, and then look at the scripture. What kind of expectations do the scriptures lay down for a godly society? What would a holy commonwealth look like? If you know much about Luther, you know that Luther gets really nervous when you talk about the law. Okay, laws terrify people and send them to the gospel, which forgives them. Calvin says, well, once you're forgiven, you're going to ask yourself, okay, now that I'm forgiven, I want to know how to live. And he says, well, a great thing to do is go to scripture, find some laws, try to build these laws into what a visibly holy society would look like. That's the job of the church. The job of the state is to learn that from the church and enforce it. So when Calvin went to Geneva, he told people that's what he was about, and they begged him to stay. That lasted for about 2 years. Then they begged him to leave. And he did. Then they thought about it for a while, and after a few more years, they asked him to come back. And he said, okay, I'll come back. But if I do, you have to understand that I'm serious about this, and I will do my best to create a visibly holy society. A society where there is no contradiction between being a Christian and being a citizen. All right. The reason this isn't the same as Christ of culture is that here it's really the church that determines what it is to be holy, and then the state enforces that. So it's the church really transforming what the culture began as and making it into something holy. And if you didn't like that, Calvin said, you really shouldn't live in Geneva. Because, well, in the same way that, you know, some of us belong to clubs and stuff, and, you know, if you don't want to play softball, don't join the team. You know, if you'd rather do something else, then get with a group that does something else. If you want to be in a visibly holy society that glorifies God, where there's never a contradiction between your public and private life, where everything that you do is in obedience to Christ, then move to Geneva. Okay, let me hear it. What's your assessment of that one?
How long did he stay the second time?
He stayed until his death, although it was rumored that the most popular name for dogs in Geneva was Calvin.
How many people moved out of Geneva?
Calvin was lucky in that he was a French Protestant and a refugee from France. And in the time that Calvin was in Geneva, a lot of refugees, Protestants from France, moved into Geneva. That helped him enormously. Calvin was actually not a dictator in Geneva. He was merely like the head pastor. And he didn't have dictatorial powers at all, but he obviously was a person of great influence.
It's interesting that given that framework, that it's Geneva that is the headquarters for the World Council of Churches. It's not, you know, Wittenberg or Eisleben or Eisenach or any of those. And also the headquarters for the European branch, at least, of the United Nations, in terms of transforming society.
And of the Lutheran World Federation.
Yeah.
Kind of Swiss banks.
Calvin.
But Calvin actually thought he could get a holy society by the course of law, primarily.
He said a visibly holy society. Now, what was true of your heart inside you, that's not for the state or the church to legislate, because only
so,
God.
So the heavy emphasis there was law that would transform culture. And Luther would opt for gospel and the response of gratitude, which would be faulty, but still grateful. So the motivation would be different.
Well, I think they both want to serve God. Calvin's just a lot more confident that you can, that if you go to the Bible and find laws, that they won't be oppressive to people. I think Luther, as you know, always thought that listing things that Christians ought to do would just send people into despair, because they would realize if they were honest that in fact they couldn't do those things perfectly. And so I think his stress is much more sort of on spontaneous love for the neighbor, whereas Calvin's love is not spontaneous, it is very ordered.
So is that really love? It's kind of more like law.
Well, it seems as though Luther is, from a Christian point of view, is more realistic as to how things really do happen. Whether you like it or not, it's realistic.
In Geneva, during Wesley's time was, Calvin's time, pardon me, was, you know, was that a perfect city? Was there no crime or anything?
No, it wasn't perfect, but it it was ordered. Yeah, I mean, compared to walking into, I guess, a typical German city, you would have noticed the difference immediately.
Still ordered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Presbyterians, you know, are very big on doing things decently and in order. There is no more ordered people than the Presbyterians. But actually, than many Presbyterians.
Not at all.
Calvin would have said, it's a wild freedom to live in a community that wants to live by the gospel. That, you know, yeah, there are laws that we have chosen to follow, but the point is we have chosen to follow them. In the same way that you might say maybe your marriage is a very free experience for you, even though it obviously it limits your behavior, still it frees you within those limits. Calvin thought discipline was really important. He said that as the saving doctrine of Christ is the soul of the church, so discipline forms the ligaments which connect the members together. And by discipline, he meant, you know, getting your shit together, basically. You know, if you know this is right and you're a Christian, you do it. And everybody does it. That's what it is to be transformed. You don't just sit around and whine all the time. You really are different. And that's a liberating experience, Calvin said. I think...
How does this relate to Dutch Reform?
Dutch Reformed are descended from Calvin.
And yet Holland now seems to be the hotbed of a lot of innovation and freedom.
Really?
Well, that's particularly
yeah, that's
in
true.
The Dutch Catholic Church. I don't know about the Reform, but the Dutch Catholic
Church. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, the Dutch Reform in South Africa now.
Yeah.
That's a rigid group.
Calvinists, I think, do tend to be rigid because they are so serious about these laws. And for people not with the program, they feel very intolerant. You know, you shouldn't live in Geneva if you didn't want to live like this. But on the other hand, you know, how can you be a group that's committed to a lifestyle reflective of the kingdom if you aren't really serious about it? And people who aren't really serious about it won't feel that they're a part of what you're doing. Commitment and toleration is hard. They're hard partners. It's hard to see how they go together.
Well, I just wanted to note or add that of the two models, of the Lutheran model and the Calvinist model, the sort of founding model of the United States of America is the Calvinist.
Oh yeah,
and that just sort of as we're thinking about this as we go along, bringing this church that thing up to the present, the sort of personal myth of the United States of America is that it was founded to create a sort of a Calvinist perfection in this new place. Mm-hmm. So I mean, just bear that in mind.
Yeah.
Nation under God, but it is a myth, as you say.
Oh yeah, it's a personal myth. Yeah, I mean there were Calvinist attempts.
Massachusetts Bay, definitely.
In the 1800s and 1900s, we let all those Lutherans immigrate.
Yeah, and those Catholics.
Yeah, with those Catholics.
But American civil religion is a Calvinist model.
Yeah, it really is. One more group, and it's really different. It's going back to early church models, Christ against culture. These were Anabaptists, and in particular I'm thinking here of groups like Mennonites and Swiss Brethren. Swiss Brethren arose in Zurich, where Zwingli, another great Reformed leader similar to Calvin, was leading a reform. And some people began to see very clearly to them that Zwingli was stressing the Bible, but wasn't really reforming things fast enough. For example, Zwingli became convinced that worship ought to be simple, as in New Testament times, but it took him like 5 years to get rid of the Mass. Zwingli was a priest. And some of these newly formed Protestants began to say, no, that's not right at all. If you know that Scripture tells you to do something, well, you don't wait 5 years till people are ready. You do it. And eventually, they began to be convinced that cultural Christianity was just absolutely, positively wrong. That the only way to be a Christian was completely to commit your life to Christ, to be reborn. And they said, you know, most people just aren't interested in that. And that's fine for them. But for those who truly wish to be Christians, to become bone of Christ's bone, flesh of Christ's flesh, they need to be reborn. They need to make a commitment as adults. They're not ready to make that commitment when they're young. And they need to separate themselves from the sinful world. And so they're called Anabaptists because they believed in adult baptism, not infant baptism. They thought that was scriptural. But of course, by law, everybody in Europe, unless they were Jewish, was baptized as a child. So they were doing re-baptisms, according to the Lutherans and the Calvinists. Real baptisms, according to them. They said, we just want to live according to the perfection of the Sermon on the Mount. Now, the state falls below the perfection of Christ. It serves God because evil people need a sword to coerce them. And so, for that reason, we support the work of the state, but we wish to have nothing to do with it. We don't want to be compromised by it. We don't want to be part of a cultural Christianity. We want to live in community as an example to the rest of the world that it really is possible to have a different lifestyle, a lifestyle completely obedient to Christ. They're pacifists, completely non-resistant. They say that anything not connected with the gospel is evil, and they just want to refute it. The only kind of discipline that they use among themselves is what they call the ban. And you know what the ban is? Mm-hmm. What? Tell the group. Enlighten the group.
Yeah, my the one I'm familiar with is probably somewhat modified, but it's, you're just really socially cut off from the group. No one talks to you. Your spouse won't talk to you. Or anything else. It's like being in a Muslim society and becoming a Christian. You've cut yourself totally off from the culture and everyone else.
Yeah. There's a passage in Matthew where it talks about if somebody's screwing up, you go and tell that person. If they're still screwing up, you go and tell them again. And then if they're still screwing up, you admonish them in front of the whole congregation. Then if they're still screwing up, you shun them. And the Anabaptists said, in our community, that's really the only form of coercion that we'll use. And we use that because there's a clear example of it in the gospel. But we will not fight, we will not prosecute, we will not serve in the army, of course. We will not serve in the government either, because the government exists to coerce. And that's just not the way we live. What we are is an example of God's kingdom. And the best way to convert people is not to compromise, really to show them an alternative reality. And then the world can see the truth of the gospel, and people can choose if they want to live according to that lifestyle. And they said, that's how you become a Christian community. It's not like Luther said, where you compromise all the time. And it's not like Calvin said, where you force people to recreate their society. It's by choice, by creating a community that chooses to live in a way that's absolutely in conjunction with the gospel.
They even have funerals, don't they? When many people leave, and just...
Oh, really? I don't
think... The Amish do it.
Huh, that's interesting.
And they call it shunning.
Mm-hmm.
But where's the concept of forgiveness in that?
Well, the whole point of that is to bring someone to forgiveness, because the person has become hardened against the group. And the only purpose is to bring someone to forgiveness. And when a person repents, it's over.
Well,
But do they try to make an effort to bring them back?
Yeah, that procedure said if you have something against your brother, you go talk to your brother about it.
But I mean, after they shun them, do they try again, or do they just...
Well, you really don't have, you're not supposed to have regular sexual intercourse with the person. And the person, you know, can still live in the house and eat at a different table, can still go to church, but no, I mean, no, you don't preach to them in particular. You don't really have much to do with them at all.
And if they stay around, the object is to get them to repent and mm-hmm. come back in, and that's okay, then they are.
Yeah, fine. Then it's over. Mm-hmm. But again, think of all the ways our society has of coercing people. Just from sending threatening, you know, little notes saying, we've noticed you haven't filed your taxes, to, you know, imprisoning people, even executing people. For the Anabaptists, the only thing is the ban. And against the outside community, all you offer is non-resistant love.
Or even like a, I don't know if that would ever happen in their society, but if it was a violent crime, would that still just be pushed to ban them?
Mm-hmm. Well, violent crime is safe in our society. It's going to take care of it whether your community wants to or not.
Yeah, but yeah, that, you know, if you can imagine a situation where the community was isolated, say, and not subject to any other state's laws, yeah, there would be no violent answer to a violent crime. A lot of people, I think, when they try to critique this model, say that it's politically naive. I can't get a sense for whether you think it is or not.
Well, the way our culture reacted to the Amish was to say that they would not be allowed to educate their children at home, that they would have to send them to state schools because it was a state law that all children be educated in a public setting, unless they were in a state-approved mm-hmm. private school. And that went on for a long time. That battle went on for a long time. The Amish finally won, mainly because their children just simply disappeared out of the system. And since they lived such a secluded life, it was very difficult for state truant officers to find the kids because they disappeared them whenever they saw them coming.
One of the reasons there are so few Amish in this country and so few Anabaptists anywhere in the world is that most of them died. They never made it out of the Reformation period. Everyone persecuted them. Protestants drowned them and Catholics burned them. And I mean, it's...
They didn't reproduce it. They were shunned from each other either.
It was just, yeah, it was almost impossible to make it out alive.
So just, they felt their witness was this purity of...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I spent some time in the Plymouth Brethren, and they, not totally the same model, and not all were pacifist by any means, that's kind of personal, but the model of, you know, if you have something against your brother, you go speak to your brother, and that doesn't work, then you take two others in the church with you, so you have witnesses to work with them. And there's a time period where you're struggling with that, but eventually, they didn't call it the ban, but eventually you would be put out and would not be allowed to enter into the worship and so forth. Of course, in a pluralistic society like ours, you don't, if you don't want to repent, you know, you just walk down the street and go to the next community church or Bible church or Baptist church or something and join that. But if you really want to get back into that smaller community, yes, you do. You end up eventually having to repent or else saying goodbye. You know, there's not much trouble here to find somebody else to associate with. And it does it does cut down your church growth, though.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm not clear what you mean by saying the Anabaptists died. Of course, all the groups died. But what do you mean?
I mean, they were killed.
Right. But the strain of Anabaptism, I mean, that strain continued much like the Lutheran Calvinist strain continued.
the strain continues, but the number of people who actually can trace their heritage back to the Reformation period is infinitesimal compared to the Calvinists and the Lutherans.
I'm not sure about that, because I think all the Mennonites, all the Brethren, and so many of
not
the,
Brethren.
But in terms of the impulse, in terms of what they looked to it in the Reformation.
Oh, sure, and theologically it didn't die, but in terms of communities that actually practiced it.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm.
Where do the Quakers fit into that?
Quakers are just later. I think they start in England. But no, certainly the theological influence doesn't die. And people continually come back to the Anabaptists. One of the ideas that the Anabaptists have that I think is interesting, they have this concept called Gelassenheit, which means yieldedness. And they feel that in order truly to be transformed by Christ's Spirit, you must yield yourself to that process. And sometimes it's very painful. But they say that Christ yielded himself even unto death. And some Anabaptists, like the Hutterites, and there are actually quite a few Hutterites in the Northern Plain states and like in Manitoba, they said that Gelassenheit, being yielded, went so far as to live in a complete community of goods where no one owns anything privately, just like the church in, oh, say, the fourth chapter of Acts did. And so they said that being yielded, experiencing Gelassenheit, goes so far as even living with people and sharing with them and not claiming anything for your own. And I think if while you're here, you're living in much closer relationships, or maybe just physically closer to a lot of people than you're used to at home, you get a sense of that Gelassenheit as well, that yieldedness, that it is hard to live in community, and they knew that too, but they were committed to it as they were committed to the cross.
Did they live in family though? Families,
or was that? Yeah, they would live in families. But, oh, like a typical Hutterite community today, you might have a big building where people lived, and families would have separate apartments, but not separate dwellings. So it would be, you know, this apartment, all in the same hall, and no one would have a kitchen. All the cooking would be done communally together. And also people wouldn't tend to shut their doors. There'd just be a sort of free interflow of traffic.
And the children would be taken care of by all the aunts and uncles.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I have a simple question, probably simplistic, but as I look at this, is anybody a purist? For instance, anybody, do we today tend to, Lutherans tend to follow today Lutheran theology to the letter, or do we become a mix? I find myself a great mix.
Yeah, I think most people are.
I'm a little of each, and then I think maybe I should crawl under the chair because I sort of feel I may be the out of step one. Are we all a little bit out of step?
Well,
and how about this? I guess this is a silly question. I never had to face it before this at this moment quite like this.
Well,
I get my answer.
Any purists out there?
You have characterized sort of types, which I don't think any of us.
That's right.
Fit. Yeah. And we may not equally share all three, but we share parts of a couple or emphasize them, mix them in different ways. But I'm sure we're all somewhat mixed here.
In other words, we're all normal, or we're all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I wondered about that. I got to thinking, where's my Lutheranism?
Well, you're giving the type as it developed in that century period.
That's right, yeah.
And you got to remember, a number of years have happened since then, and some kind of modifications come in.
But, I mean, there are real differences among them. You know, I mean, all of them are saying gosh, sin is really terrible, it's perverted the world. Two of them, Calvin and the Anabaptists, are saying, yes, but grace really regenerates people. It makes possible a lifestyle, not just privately, but socially, that really mirrors the kingdom. And Luther isn't saying that at all. There's a real distinction between personal Christian lifestyle and then Christian vocation in government as a citizen. And in one place, the Sermon on the Mount is applicable, in the other place, it isn't. Although I think a lot of people would ask just how much Sermon on the Mount you actually see in Geneva. I think Calvin wouldn't have put Sermon on the Mount as the central thing that everybody ought to be trying to emulate.
But at least for me, as a Lutheran, I still feel that I have to live my Christianity in my work or whatever I do. I can't just leave it behind in my personal life. I mean, that's my life.
I was thinking of Wilson Day. I would think Lutherans in Southern Africa now would become Calvinists, or have a strain of that, because mm-hmm. they really want to transform the situation and not be satisfied, at least with the caricature you've made of early Lutherans.
Caricature is the word I heard.
of acceptance of the given order. Because it comes with authority.
Mm-hmm. No, in fact, the Lutherans are very strong.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking about Luther's concept of vocation, mm-hmm. calling, and that would seem to move over into transforming culture, because he said your whole vocation is based upon the forgiveness of sins, and he's talking about your daily work. Mm-hmm. And everything that you do, whether you're a nurse or a doctor or whatever you happen to be, or a mother wiping the kid's nose or something like that, that's part of your vocation under the forgiveness of sins. Doesn't that overlap then a little bit?
Well, yeah, but let's look at it another way. Forgiveness of sins also frees you to do things that are below the perfection of the Sermon on the Mount. So that, yeah, people who have, everyone has a vocation, and they live it fully. And if your vocation is in government, for example, you live it out of love for your neighbor. But that isn't the same as making government Christian.
No, I don't say that at all. And yet, what do we think now? Now, the moral majority, let's take that as a case.
Okay.
That would fit in there.
That's a fairly neutral case, all right?
It seems to me that fits in the Calvinistic mold.
Sure.
And yet, I don't know whether any of us, most of us here perhaps would say, well, that's not the way to go at all. We don't agree with the moral majority. But we still think that we should be supporting the kinds of things that will make the government do what's right in their policy, let's say Central mm-hmm. America or towards mm-hmm. Southern Africa or towards people in poverty and so forth. So what we're Lutherans may feel that way, or some Lutherans are Calvinists to that extent. Then is that would you use that kind of terminology?
No, because you're not ready to jump in and join the moral majority.
Uh-huh.
I mean, in their style of trying to do it, they're not willing to do it in the same way that some Calvinists are.
Although I think I would not classify moral majority in the Calvinist bracket. I would put them in the Christ of culture bracket. Because,
so it doesn't fit in any of those three?
Well, that's just my prejudice. I mean, I think where they get many, many of their values is not from Christianity at all. It's their cultural values that they then overlay on Christianity.
Well, that's true. You were right about that.
I would say, for my own self, when I think about Christ transforming culture, I feel that it only works and it's only justifiable if you really want to do it the way Calvin did it, or the moral majority, say, if we call them Christ transforming. It's only justifiable if people are agreed that that's what they want. I think it's fine in Massachusetts Bay. people came over, that's what they wanted. It's totally inappropriate, I would say, in a pluralistic society like our own. I mean, it's just crazy to cram religion down people's necks. I do wish that we could appeal to a common morality, and there's where the model from Aquinas that we looked at yesterday could be really helpful. Because, you know, he says everyone shares in a God-given ethic. That's what natural law is. You don't have to be a Christian, specifically, to know those kinds of truths. I think today we're really stuck. We want the government to be moral, but we're so pluralistic that none of us really agree what moral means anymore. And we're real uncomfortable when Jerry Falwell says he knows what moral means.
Yep.
Okay, so are the Lutherans mad at me?
What does Luther actually say it would be okay to be an executioner?
Yes, he does say that. He says hangman. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But not a vigilante.
Oh, no. Well,
yeah, definitely. Yeah. I'd be willing to say that people who press a button for the electric chair are Christians.
Yeah.
You know, there might be Christians who do that. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it depends on your definition.
Well, lots of Christians are favoring capital punishment. Mm-hmm. Right. That means they have to say the guy who presses the button is okay.
Yeah. Or I think also, before you say Luther's too schizophrenic, you ought at least give him the courtesy of realizing when he says, as private Christians we obey the Sermon on the Mount, that that's a profound kind of Christianity that most of us, I think, never even approach. You know, I mean, he really means non-resistant Christianity, and I don't think that many of us ever approach that. We have no intention of not returning evil for evil if someone attacks us. So he may have a sharp contradiction, but at least when he's talking about personal Christianity, it's profound, and it takes risks.
So why give always the Sermon on the Mount is model. I mean, you're
why?
Speaking of it, yeah.
Because that's where you get the most demands for perfection. You know, once you read through that and you're not returning evil for evil, you're not resisting, you're loving your enemies, it seems like those are the highest demands conceivable. And if it's a long sermon and, you know, it's hard to miss it.